From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in all-new Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk gaming and game development.
I'm Ellen Burns-Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Stephen McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Arthur Croy. I, too, make nice games. For this week's episode, our topics are meetings and frustration. No, wait, that's backwards. It's frustration, then meetings. Anyway, if everyone's ready, let's start.
Oops. I forgot to switch that.
We're making mistakes already.
The endless loop of meetings and frustration.
You know, is it actually important that we say the topics in the right order when in the intro? We've always done it, but does it matter?
Nicegames.club/feedback.
Yeah.
Tell us, listener. Was that an error or did I overcorrect?
It was an error. I forgot to, because we switched the order out. Mm-hmm. Or I switched the order out and then I didn't switch the order fully. It's fine.
I think it worked out well because if you had just read it straight through, there would have been tons of intro music time left.
That's true. Yeah. That's like that's a DJ trick I learned in when I was doing college radio, is like all the music in the library had a little card on the inside of the CD and it said like which of the songs that are favorited by the person who reviewed that disc when it came into the library. So when you can just pick a random disc off the shelf and you kind of know what the good singles are. You've never heard of it because someone has done that work for you. But then also it tells you like how long the intro is. So you know how long you have to talk before that beat hits or the first lyric comes in.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes you're going so fast, you grab a random thing, like, and pick that song. You start playing it. Then you look at how long the intro is.
Oh. Oops.
And then you've got like, okay, I've got 15 seconds to fill. And then you just learn to fill it. Exactly. That's the one skill that like serves me now. Like all the other skills I learned as a college radio DJ have not helped me in any other part of my life.
Mark is surrounded by audio equipment. He's like, no, it's that one skill. That's the one skill.
It kind of is. The rest of this stuff you can learn elsewhere. But we're a little giddy today because we are recording for the very first time in the brand new clubhouse.
Yeah.
Do-do-do-do.
It's nice. It's very nice.
I've been doing nothing but thinking about opening up this office space, which we've talked about in a previous episode. For my company Noble Robot, and here we are, and we've built new walls and put in a ceiling for a new recording space in the office. It's been on my mind for the last couple months, and I've been thinking about almost nothing but that. So I just want to hear the two of you talk about it for a little while.
Well, when we were making the notes script for this episode, like a little bit before we started recording today, and Ellen and me noticed right away how much of an office this felt like. Like it felt like a workspace. You can actually get work done.
Yeah.
It felt really nice.
Yeah. Well, I mean, kind of leading up to today, you know, Mark and Dale have been in here like every day over the last week, just putting in long, long hours, putting things together and getting deliveries and putting things together and putting things together and carrying things up the stairs and carrying things up the stairs and putting things together.
A lot of work.
Well, Ellen's is mentioning carrying things up the stairs because Ellen, you carried a lot of stuff up the stairs.
I helped carry things up the stairs. Yes.
Yeah, it was great.
I did carry some heavy desktops, even if they're from IKEA, are heavy. And I would not have categorized that as a lot of stairs before carrying desktops up the stairs. But yeah, you guys have been here like all week, just putting in all this time. And we've, you know, Steven, you and I have been here a little bit here and there helping to put things together. We were part of like a desk assembly line on Friday, which was kind of fun.
Yeah.
But it's not all put together. Like there's a ton that is put together. It definitely looks more put together than not. I feel like we're on step 5 of 6.
Yeah. It feels like you can see what it looks like now. Like you got a pretty solid idea.
Yeah.
But it was still about 60% assembled. So there's still stuff to do.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, but I think it's going to be easier going forward. I think we did the hard stuff.
Yeah.
First.
Yeah. The hard stuff is done. And it's definitely closer. I guess the reason I was kind of framing it that way is because it's put together enough that you can sit down at a desk. And even if the desktop is still wrapped in cardboard, you put your laptop down and you can start working. And it just immediately puts you into that productive headspace.
Yeah.
Which happened to both Steven and to me. And then all of a sudden I realized like when I was done doing the thing, I'm like, oh, that just happened. It happened so naturally. It felt so good and just so easy to do. And the lighting is perfect. Like the color palette is perfect for that. And it just has a really nice positive energy, but also just very focusing. And I didn't realize how much I didn't have that at my home office until I came in and started working here. So that was surprising. I thought I had a pretty good setup at home. The dogs are distracting, of course, but apparently I didn't. So I have to think about that a little bit. Or not, because I have a solution.
Yeah.
It's come here.
And of course, meanwhile, I've been more than once like hinting at you that I want you to bring your dogs here. I want office dogs, but that's kind of part of your problem. So I don't think it's going to happen.
Well, it won't happen all the time.
Right.
Because they can be distracting, and also because Steven's not a huge fan
that's true,
of dogs.
Yeah.
It's not just dogs. It's most animals.
Yeah.
It's no offense to your
dogs. No, that's, I don't, my dogs don't take it personally.
Okay, good. Yeah.
They don't, Mark, you might be sad to hear this. They don't listen to the podcast. My dogs don't listen to the podcast.
What?
They're just not into game development like at all.
Yeah.
But we'll do it once in a while. We'll bring in, you know, Pixel or Dante, never both.
Yeah, I just bought all this new like furniture, so like maybe I shouldn't be so excited to bring a couple of your animals in.
We'll just train them not to get up on the, I mean, they usually get up on the furniture at home because I like to cuddle with the dogs and I'm on the furniture, so but we'll just train them not to get up on this furniture. No problem. And then if I get them like a nice cushy dog bed,
yeah,
they should be fine with that.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this in the Nice Thinking episode where we were sort of fantasizing about the stuff we're going to do at the office, but there's just so much ahead of us, like so many cool things we can do. And but a lot of it's just going to be coming in and working. Like that's going to be, you know, that's what now is about, is setting it up so that we can just come in and work. But I sort of can't help but think about all the other things we can do with the space and with the time we're spending here and all of that. So it's pretty exciting.
You guys, I'm going to brag on Mark's behalf.
Ooh.
For a second. There's a fridge in here.
Yeah.
The fridge is hooked up and it is cold. There is pop in there.
Yeah.
And Mark, maybe with Dale's help, I don't know, you didn't tell that part of the story, but flipped the door around.
Yeah.
Like the hinge was on the wrong side and they flipped. I wasn't even aware that was a thing you could do.
Ellen sounds really impressed. And some people at home are like, don't all fridges do that? It's true. All fridges do that. But it's hard, apparently.
Yeah, they don't make it easy.
I got it thinking like, oh, I think all fridges come with the door opening to the right, like a standard, because I think most kitchens are laid out that way. Mm. And
like with the opening, the handle's on the left and then you open it and it swings to the right.
Yes. And so I was sort of suspecting I would have to flip it because of the way we have the fridge here, but I was crossing my fingers that it would just come left-handed, you know? But it didn't. And it's like, okay, whatever. It'll take a little while to remove the doors and do the thing. It's fine. It's like a 30-step process. Oh. It has like 18 different bolts and a bunch of, you need a putty knife. Take a bumper from a, it feels very Stone Age the way these things are built. Like, so I'm very angry at Whirlpool for this dumb refrigerator, but I mean, it's a really nice fridge. It's perfect size. It's everything we need. But man, I spent way too much time. Like yesterday I built 8 desks and swapped one door. I spent equal time on both tasks.
Oh my God.
Like, that's how frustrating it was.
That's ridiculous.
Does IKEA make fridges?
They do, in fact.
Well, Mark, what the heck?
They're a little more expensive than I wanted to.
Okay.
They're probably just as annoying to deal with too.
That's probably true. There's just something, as I was taking this thing apart and just seeing all of the, like, anyone who's like worked with a fridge or replaced something or repaired it, like, well, if they haven't, you know, a fridge just looks like a piece of modern technology, but it's really not. It's like the most old-fashioned thing. And they still build them in this like old-fashioned way. Nothing is at a perfect right angle. Everything is like bent and weird, and it's so bizarre. I don't know. That struck me because everything else, like I've taken apart a microwave. Like, you know, I mean, that's another story. But like, you know, those look like modern. You know, those screws are in the right place. Like, it's just it's designed with some elegance. Refrigerator is just not. It's weird.
I wonder if smart refrigerators are more advanced in that way.
I bet not.
Yeah.
I think they're just regular refrigerator with an Android tablet on the door. Like,
that makes sense.
You know, because it's all out of sight, you know. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm talking way too much about this because it took up a lot of my thoughts yesterday.
It seems like a lot of work.
Yeah. Yeah. It was tough, but it's worth it because now the fridge opens correctly and it's cold inside.
Yeah. Chilly. Yeah. We can put snacks in there.
Yeah.
We can put leftovers in there.
Nice.
Leftovers from all the restaurants nearby.
There's a lot of restaurants
nearby. Yeah, this neighborhood is great. That's the thing that's really striking. Is just this is going to be a perfect place to work, independent of how cool the office itself is.
Yeah.
Cool people, cool office, cool neighborhood. Good job. High five. Yeah. Good job, Steve.
Oh, I didn't do anything.
Yeah, you did. You put together some desks.
I sort of.
And you know, I mean, like, we all, at least you and I, we're like, yes, we're going to do this, Mark.
Yeah.
We're in.
Yeah.
So we helped in that.
That's true.
Yeah. I'll say that has been a big motivator because, like we talked about before, like, I need to rent out desks in order to help pay for the rent. Mm-hmm. And having the two of you on board so early before everything was settled, like, really, really helped, like, my state of mind to know that this is a project I can take on.
Yeah.
So I really, really appreciate it. So thank you both for that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, on to something completely different from the joyousness we're experiencing here in the new space.
The whole next topic is about Whirlpool.
Basically. That's an excellent transition. Yeah. So we've been talking about, like, the joy of being in this space. I have to say that, at least for me this morning, the process of getting here was not joyous. It was frustrating. I woke up late because I set my alarm, but didn't realize that it was only set for Saturday and not for Sunday too. You know, usually you have, like, a weekday alarm, you have a weekend alarm. Yep. That's how I usually set it up. But apparently last weekend, I changed my weekend alarm to only be for Saturday because of Eric's race. And I didn't fix it. So it only was set for Saturday and it wasn't set for today. So I woke up at like 9:15. Mm-hmm. We were going to get here by 10 a.m.
Yeah.
I'm like, ah!
Well, real quick, you mentioned it. You got to brag on your husband's achievement in that thing.
Yeah.
That's very impressive.
My husband Eric ran a 70.3 mile triathlon. So it's a half Ironman distance. Although Ironman is a branded term, so it's technically wasn't part of, like, the Ironman franchise, so it can't be called a half Ironman, but it was the same distance as a half Ironman.
It's
so
half metal dude.
It's half metal dude. Half metal dude. Yeah. Man. Yeah, so it was a mile-long swim and, like, a 56-mile bike and a 13.1-mile run, a half marathon at the end. So he did it. He's been training for it for months, and he went out, and it was a beautiful day for a race, and he had a really good time, and he did the whole thing. He swam the thing, he biked the thing, he ran the thing, and we had a little cheering squad out there. We put together, like, a playlist for his run, which had a lot of really, like, varied things in there. Everything from, like, Perturbator to, you know, Mumford and Sons and the Rocky theme. Anyway, and yeah, he finished it. I think he finished it in 5 hours and 43 minutes, which is really good for his first time. So he's excited. I'm not going to say that. I was going to say he's excited for the next one. I'm not sure if he's there yet.
Give him a few weeks.
Yeah, he's been recovering this week, but he's starting to talk like he's excited for the next one.
With that. The frustration memories are fading.
You're right.
The frustration. All that's left is the joy of having done it.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So anyway, that's why my alarm was set all weird. And it came back to bite me in the face this morning when I needed to get up around 8 and got up around 9:15. So then I got ready and I got in the car and I was going to pick Steven up on the way, and then Google Maps gave me the wrong directions to Steven's place because I thought I was biking and not driving. And I thought I was biking, not driving, because I was biking here on Friday. Anyway, yeah, so we all know what frustration is like in real life. Mm-hmm. But what I was hoping to do today is not just complain, but talk about it more from, like, a philosophical perspective, as, like, an emotional component of game design, right?
Ooh, yeah.
So we talk about, you know, wanting to target certain emotions in the game design process. Mm-hmm. And also to kind of shape an emotional journey throughout the game. Because if you just have it's just a flat emotional state, that's not fun. That's not engaging. If you just have, you're just not going to get anywhere. You can't have an emotional, like, plateau. Yeah. You need to have movement from one emotional state to the next. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to talk about frustration and kind of its place in that landscape when you're trying to, you know, paint or cultivate an experience using a game. So I wanted to start just by kind of talking about frustration in life, because that's really where we kind of build our core experience of frustration before we bring that emotion to the game space. And yeah, so that is a slight like day in the life slice of what frustration in my life looks like. How about you guys? Oh, well, actually, we already talked about Mark's frustration.
Yeah, I'll sit this one out.
Steven?
How have I experienced frustration? I never experienced frustration. I've always
kind of... Yeah, no, incorrect.
I know. Can't get them past y'all. I guess, like, I don't know. I guess the way I tend to experience frustration is like, oh, I know, in Unity.
Oh, it's all coming back to you now.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing about frustration is like, you don't, unless it's like really bad, you don't really think about it that much. You think about the highs a lot more, or the very low lows. At least the way I'm thinking of it right now. And so like with Unity, sometimes I have a hard time with like the documentation. But then I don't think about, I recognize that like the documentation is bad, but then I don't think about it until after the fact. Like I'll think about that I got this thing in that I wanted to get in, and not about the 3 hours it took me looking up all of the things I needed to do on the Unity forums because the Unity documentation is bad to get to that point. I guess that's kind of weird. Like that's kind of how I'm thinking about it too. And I think I feel like that way with respect to like video games too. Like if I'm frustrated with this boss or whatever, I think about, oh, I had a lot of frustration. I don't think about how much frustration I had about it. I think about the triumph I got after that point sometimes. Or I get to the point where like I'm so frustrated that I can't deal with this game anymore and I'm done with it. But then that's like a low at that point, right? So yeah, I don't know. I guess that's how I've experienced it.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
That makes sense. I think what I'm pulling out from the three stories that we've shared, one, my bad morning, two, Mark's frustrating fridge, and three, Steven's Unity experiences, which probably echo a lot of other Unity experiences, is like frustration comes when you have a goal in mind and then you're not able to meet it in the way that you expected to be able to meet it.
Yes.
Right? Because like you expected to have to put in some work on the fridge.
Yes.
And you expect to do some research around Unity.
Right.
And I expected to be able to come pick you up on the way to the office this morning. But then like running into snags that you didn't envision as part of the process of doing that, maybe is like what the kernel of frustration.
Like, yeah, it seems like it's entirely about expectations. Because if you set, I mean, for example, like a lot of the IKEA building I've been doing has not frustrated me.
Yeah.
Because I know exactly how hard it's going to be.
Right.
And I know how tired I'm going to be and how much my back is going to hurt at the end of the day. And that doesn't bother me in the same way, other than just the back pain.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't frustrate me because I kind of know exactly what it's going to be.
Yeah.
But the fridge frustrated me because I knew it was going to be like a little silly, but I didn't realize it was going to be as many points of failure as it had, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Like I knew I was going to get on the road this morning and I didn't know that my carefully planned route was correct, but Google was going to tell me it was wrong. Like,
yeah. Well, like you knew you were going to be tired from getting up so early on a Sunday. But,
yeah.
But you then had a totally different difficult experience than what you were expecting.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I knew today was going to be different because we were recording a couple hours earlier than we usually do. That has so far, yes, the experience has been a bit different, but I didn't expect to have the additional frustration of waking up late. Yeah. And Steven, for you, let me know if this resonates, but like you expect to have to put in some work to make some stuff work in Unity.
Yes.
And you expect to have to look some things up.
Yes.
But then you don't have to expect to look up the looking up to look up the looking up, like to just keep on researching to try to make sense of the documentation.
Yeah, I also expect Unity to have documentation on how this function works.
Yeah.
And then they don't. And then I have to figure it out myself. And it's like a trial and error sort of thing. And it's annoying.
And it's always a forum post from 2014.
Yep.
That like has, it's the only information about a particular API on the entire internet. Exactly. And then you're like, but that doesn't seem, usually, okay, that looks correct, but it's 7 years old and things change. Yeah. I'm going to keep looking. And then you're just kind of and you spend, wandering the wilderness you spend looking the next for corroboration. 2 hours,
yeah, trying to find any other kind of article.
Yeah. And then you find something from 2017 and it says something different. Mm-hmm. You're like, what? You're like, why did I even look?
Or if the worst thing is when you find a post or whatever and they're like, I'm having this problem. It's like the exact same problem you're having. And they're like, I solved it. They don't tell you how they solved it.
Yeah.
It's happened too many times. Like, please just tell me how you did it.
Yeah.
Please. I'm just picturing this as like a metaphorical walk through the desert of the internet. And there's like a dead cow skull over here and like a tumbleweed going over here. And yep. It's like, I'm searching for the well of truth about this API. Yep. I've been walking for days. No water.
Yep.
Anyway.
But yeah, no, that's a good point. I expect to be able to. I expect to have that documentation readily accessible, and I expect to like look up some stuff because at this point I know Unity's documentation isn't going to give me all the answers, and it can't give me all the answers anyways, right? I expect it to take some time, but it just takes longer than I think, and I don't expect to have to do trial and error and stuff, and that becomes frustrating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'll budget like an extra hour to figuring a thing out, and then it will take 3 hours.
Yep,
and then you're just like, why did I even budget the hour? Why didn't I just have an open-ended research session.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's exactly it.
So what about your experience of frustration in games? That's the next question. Mm-hmm. And I think we can look at this in two different ways, because like there are some games where they're just, my experience was very low frustration. And that isn't to say that like everyone has low frustration around this particular game. It's just I had an experience that had low frustration, and we can dig into that a little bit. So a couple of the ones that I wanted to mention were Spiritfarer, which I haven't finished, but played a little bit of, and it's so far very low frustration. Mm-hmm. Firewatch is another one, and Breath of the Wild is the third one. Mm-hmm. So I think Spiritfarer and Firewatch are similar, at least so far, in that it's a very like linear experience. There are some points in Firewatch specifically where I've gotten like turned around and lost and like couldn't figure out where I was, and that was a little frustrating because I, you know where I need to get, like I can see where I need to get on the map and I need to get there, but you can't just like can't walk through the landscape like you would be able to if you were in a real landscape.
Yeah.
Which is probably good, because if I were to take the shortcuts that I tried to take in Firewatch and I were to take them in real life, I'd probably break some bones, so maybe it's a good thing. But like there's a little bit of frustration there where like I know where I need to get, but I can't find the route there. However, I usually quickly find the route there. I know that if I just keep looking around, I'll eventually figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And so that game is pretty low frustration for me. In Breath of the Wild, the same thing. I think that the thing about Breath of the Wild that was different is like whenever I was having trouble progressing or something, I had that same experience. Like I know where I need to go, but I'm having difficulty getting past an enemy to get there, or beating something in order to get the thing that I need, or figuring out that puzzle. There's like an entire world full of other stuff to do.
Yeah.
So I don't have to sit with that frustration. I can give myself a new, different goal for a period of time that I can quickly make progress towards and kind of alleviate that frustration that I was feeling around like the main goal or my initial goal. So I think that's one of the reasons that Breath of the Wild wasn't very it didn't really feel frustrating for me, even though there were some moments that were really, really challenging.
Yeah.
They didn't feel frustrating because I didn't have to sit with that feeling.
Yeah.
So yeah, those are my experiences of like games that were low frustration.
You know, it's interesting that that's the cure for frustration in Breath of the Wild, because as you get toward once you start getting when you're going for the last two shrines, or if for those people crazy enough, the last dozen Korok seeds or so,
yeah,
then the frustration increases because there's less to distract you. You can't change tracks as easily as you could early in the game when there were more tracks to change to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, but you know, that's something that you opt into. And I think also, if you're going to go for that whole, like the 100% Korok seed or whatever, it comes back to that idea of expectations.
Right, right. Right?
Because you don't decide that you're going to go to 100%, you know, without already having some experience with doing it, right? Like just by playing the game, you're going to get a lot of the Korok seeds. Just by moving through the world, you're going to find a lot of the temples and solve some of the puzzles. And so you have an idea of what it will take to get 100%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so your expectations are set appropriately. You know, I don't know. I've never gotten 100% of Breath of the Wild. I have to ask someone who has whether it was frustrating.
Well, I did all the shrines. I didn't get all the Korok seeds. And the last few were were frustrating in that there was a lot of tedium.
Yeah.
And I have a lot of time to sit with my own thoughts of like, why am I doing this? Like the last five, maybe. Yeah. And thinking like, should I just look up where it is? Like, no, because then I won't even want to go there. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, and so I didn't. And I'm like, I probably should have just to save the time.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't have any pride on the line. I really should have just cheated.
I want to come back to the idea of looking things up at some point, too, because I think that there's something there that plays into this whole idea. But first, I want to hear from Stephen about low frustration games.
Low frustration
games. If Stephen plays any low frustration games.
All intensity all the time. no, I guess. Wow, I'm having a hard time thinking of games.
Well, I mean, like, it doesn't have to be something that, like, is typically categorized as low frustration.
Right,
it's something
right.
that you experienced low frustration.
Well, I don't think I've been playing games recently that have that. Aspect in them.
Interesting.
Like, I'm thinking, like, when I'm playing Civ 6, I play it on the highest difficulty, and I expect a certain amount of difficulty, right?
Yeah.
Challenge. Same with Humankind. I've been playing Deathloop. That game is kind of hard, mm-hmm. so I expect to die a few times. Mm-hmm. Roguelikes and things, too.
It's called Deathloop.
Yeah, Deathloop, yeah. I haven't really been playing games to relax recently, so I'm having a hard time thinking of a game that is relaxing that way. I guess like I used to play Picross mm-hmm. and stuff when I was on the train, and I can do that again now since I'll be traveling to the office.
Stephen, this is the frustration.
Right,
sorry. On topic.
and so like that, I guess like Picross is kind of low. Mm-hmm. They're easy and relaxing in some ways, but then you get to the harder puzzles and then like it takes me like an hour or something to complete those puzzles. It takes me a while to do them.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't consider that relaxing. I would just consider that distracting, sort of. Like, well, your mind's just focused on this one thing, so you don't have to think about other stuff.
I guess the way that I've been thinking about it, though, is like relaxing and frustrating definitely seem to be at odds, right?
Yeah.
But I'm not sure if difficulty and frustrating necessarily go hand in hand.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. And I was hoping to explore that idea more today. So that's why my sentence just kind of ended.
Yeah. Well, Stephen seems to have a different vocabulary for this.
Yeah.
Which is why I think you're having a difficult time kind of framing it the way Ellen's framing it.
Yeah.
But it makes a lot of sense to me how I frame it. So I think you might be the outlier here in how you, like how you remember your experience.
Yeah. Well, okay. So let's talk it out.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, a lot of the times I do tend to play a lot of hard games, I guess, mm-hmm. just because I don't know. I do think that, like, generally speaking, if I want to relax, I watch TV. I don't play games.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking for a challenge. So I'm looking for an aspect of frustration, right? But I'm expecting that. Like, I'm expecting that challenge, so it doesn't feel as frustrating in the moment when I'm playing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I'm thinking about, like, Neo 2. Actually, I'm thinking about the first time I played the first Neo. I spent like 3 hours trying to get past like literally the first checkpoint because it was so hard. And I think at that point, like, I knew it was going to be difficult and it was clear I was getting wrecked. So I knew I was going to have a hard time with it. So I just kept practicing and learning and getting better. And eventually I got to the point where I could beat that checkpoint. And I spent the next hour trying to get to the second checkpoint. But like that wasn't, it was frustrating, but engaging and, you know, challenging. So I enjoyed that. So it didn't feel frustrating.
Yeah.
You know, you've described on the show before mm-hmm. how you don't really get mad at games, like when you lose or when you're not doing well.
Mostly when I actually.
But then everyone's like, but Steven, I've seen it happen because it's multiplayer games.
Yeah.
Where you really get revved up and get your emotions rise.
Yeah, that's true.
So maybe talk about that. Like when your brother beats you at Mario Kart.
His face just changed. I wish you guys could see it.
I don't play Mario Kart. No. that's a good point. I don't tend to... Because like when I'm playing a single-player game, the only person I can get mad at it myself. And like, I don't know. I'm not good at the game.
And who could get mad at Steven?
Right? I can't even do that. Actually, that's... No. If anybody gets mad at Steven, it's Steven. but I think I do get frustrated at some multiplayer games when like I feel... I think I get frustrated at games in general, at games when I'm not doing how I expect
to,
and it's not clear why I'm not doing well.
Mm.
when I, yeah, like, exactly. Like, if I, if there's no clarity as to why, like in a fighting game, if I get beat down in a fighting game, I know I'm not as good as this other player mm-hmm. most of the time. Then I'm like, okay with that. Even in the times when I feel like I could have beat this player and I didn't, like, it's because I made some mistakes during the thing or whatever.
Right.
And I just messed up during that time. Or my, I'm not in the zone at that moment or whatever. Mm-hmm. I can deal with that. But like, if I'm playing a game, and I've had this issue with Humankind, because like, there's some things in that game that are just, to me, don't make sense. if I'm playing a game and I don't understand why this isn't working the way I expect it to, or why I'm getting beat down, then I get really frustrated with that mm-hmm. experience. I'm thinking about, actually, when we were playing, we played that detective game.
Place. You really didn't like that game.
Because
it's just Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective. Yeah. It's a board game that's sort of narrative. You play through it once. It's not replayable because you like follow a story and solve a mystery.
Yeah.
And the mechanic is you go to different parts around London and then you read from a book a story and then you mm-hmm. decide where to go next. That's mm-hmm. the basic mechanic.
Yeah.
And Steven, you hated it.
I did not. Well, I was into it when we were playing it, but like we ended up not doing well.
Right. We got very few of the clues.
And it wasn't. Like, I think we accidentally made a mistake early on in the beginning because we didn't quite understand the way that the game was trying to direct us to go.
Yeah.
And I found that very frustrating because I was like, I feel like we were doing everything correctly. We were following all the clues that the game was trying to give us, mm-hmm. and we just did poorly. So it just felt like I wasted my time.
You know, that's so funny because I think we kind of agreed what was wrong with it.
Yep.
But I really like the concept of the game so much.
Yeah.
That we made like according to the game, we made a fatal mistake early, and mm-hmm. it sent us kind of on a wild goose chase for the rest of the game.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And that's what was frustrating about
it. Right.
But that didn't bother me in the same way because I thought the core concept was so strong. I just thought that the part was just written in a little clumsy way.
Yeah.
So I just had like feedback for the designers is really all I had.
Yeah.
I liked the game too much to let that ruin it for me.
Yeah.
But
no, I didn't.
But we agreed on what the problem was.
We totally did. Yeah. We totally did. And I just think I felt like I couldn't trust the game to direct me now at this point. So I felt like if I played the game again, I would get it into that same situation.
Oh, sure. I guess so, I just had faith that it wasn't going to happen again. Or if it did, I would judge it then and not right away.
Sure. Yeah.
Huh, interesting.
I guess I had lost faith at that point.
Yeah.
I'm also reminded when we played that game, The Grizzled.
Yeah,
we recorded that.
Steven hated that game too.
If
you want to hear Steven hate that game on mic,
listen to it on Patreon. You can
join us on Patreon.
Yeah,
patreon.com/nicegameflow.
But that game, I also got frustrated with that game because, I mean, that game is intended to be punishing and very challenging.
Right, right.
And
it's supposed to make you a little sad.
Yeah, and it felt like whatever I do was going to be bad. So it didn't feel like there was any real way to like do well.
Right.
So it just it felt like a waste of time.
Yeah.
It felt like I was just going to feel bad playing the game. And I think that like it works to the benefit of that game. I feel like I said before, I think that game works in a lot of ways. Just doesn't work for me.
Right. That's what the game is supposed to do.
Exactly.
Right. And that's why I liked it, because it felt like a great marriage of theme and mechanics.
Well, mm-hmm.
But that was me just sort of like almost academically saying like it did its job really well.
Yeah.
And you're like, this isn't fun.
Exactly.
So they're both correct opinions.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, back to expectations, right? Like
Yeah.
It comes right back to expectations. You were saying, Stephen, like you choose really challenging games, you expect them to be challenging.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though you're experiencing them as challenging,
you
don't necessarily experience a high degree of frustration
because
it's aligned with your expectations.
Well, and with those games that are challenging, I expect to get better and learn from, you know, poor play or whatever and get better at the game and eventually get to the point where like it's not as challenging to do certain things anymore, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But with the games we were talking about with the Grizzled and things, it didn't feel like, at least in the moment, it didn't feel like I could get better at the game to a point where like it wouldn't be nearly as challenging as it was at that time.
Yeah.
So it just felt like any skills I learned from this game are not going to benefit me in the future. And so I don't want to play this game anymore.
Yeah. Which I think is an interesting segue to what I want to talk about next, which is just like our experiences of frustrating games. We kind of blended these two categories because mm-hmm. mm-hmm. we're already contrasting them. But like to bring it around, some of the games that I have found frustrating were like some of the Metroid games for one.
Sure.
Especially like the 2D Metroid games, like Metroid Fusion just completed that a few weeks ago. Super Metroid, which I love, has some really frustrating moments. And then I'm going to contrast that with Thoth and maybe Ori and the Blind Forest.
Yeah.
So Metroid Fusion, Super Metroid, those games like my expectation going in is that I'm going to have some moments of challenge, but I'm going to be able to figure it out. Mm-hmm. Right. And some of the things with Metroid, especially with Metroid Fusion, like there were some really frustrating moments where I wasn't figuring it out. Like, especially with the bosses, you know, like they all have like some gimmick or something that you have to do specifically to be able to make it work. And there were some like Neo Ridley and, the SAX at the end, it was just like, what? It is not clear. Like, it's not clear to me what I need to be doing.
Yeah.
I know that I'm not executing correctly, but it's also not clear what I need to be doing and what I need to be getting better at.
Right, you know?
So those specific bosses were pretty frustrating. And I did end up looking one of them up, because I just like, I was just getting too frustrated, with myself and or the game. And then when I figured out the strategy, it was ended up being really easy. And I was able to execute it like first time I tried it or like maybe the first or second time. So that was interesting. And then with Ori and the Blind Forest, that one was weird because for much of the early game, it was like very, it was very low frustration. And then there was this one sequence where I had to go, you have to like jump vertically in a bunch of different ways. And, things are like falling around you and it's really, really difficult. And what I had to just try it so many times and it was such a huge spike in challenge.
I think I know exactly the part you're talking about. I felt the same.
Yeah. It was a huge spike in challenge compared to the beginning of the game that it really, like it really felt incredibly frustrating because my expectations had been set by my early game experience.
Right.
And then this came, it seemed to come out of nowhere. Now, the interesting thing is I do remember that being really frustrating. But I'm really glad I worked through it because by the time I was done and actually had figured out how to get there, I was so good at using the controls that I could like fly through the forest, I think in the way that the game makers intended me to be able to do.
Right. You were forged by that experience.
Exactly. I was literally forged by that experience. Yeah. And the rest of the game was just like smooth sailing because I had honed my skills so much in that one sequence. I'm not sure if that's good game design.
You know, it's funny because I had almost the opposite feeling of that, where I got through that section, if this is the same one we're talking about, and it, one, if you're doing it by the 15th time you're doing it, all the drama is gone.
Yeah.
Right? All the tension and suspense and none of that music works on you anymore.
It's just grind.
It's just grind. And then when you finally beat it, you finally get that last 5%, because that's the thing that's most frustrating, is that you keep dying and dying, and you inch further and further. And sometimes that's good. And sometimes that feels really, really cool. And you do get better at the game as you go. But then when you get stuck at a part and then the end is just 5% past that. And you don't know that until you get the 5% past.
Yeah.
Then there's no sense of accomplishment.
Yeah.
Because it's like, I've done 95% of this 12 times.
Yeah.
So 100% of it does not feel good, you know.
Right. It's just like, well, yeah, I've arrived.
And it ended up souring me on the rest of the game.
Oh, interesting.
Like, I felt like, well, if this is what the game's going to do for me, like, I guess I'll finish it. I'm invested. But like, none of it was interesting to me anymore after that.
And it never really did that same thing again.
Yeah, like, that's right.
It never had that same emotional, like it never had a sequence that created that same emotional experience for me. It was the rest of the game. It's like it was that one thing that like forged my skills.
Yeah.
And then that's what they were. And the rest of the game was.
There is a similar like auto-scrolly chasey thing at the very end.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think I maybe beat that on the second try.
Yeah.
Maybe. And it might be because I was good by that point.
Yeah.
And but then the drama level is totally different. Right.
Yeah, it was interesting.
Or just that section was easier. I don't know.
I'm not sure. But it comes back to expectations, right?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, everyone's expectations are going to be different. So everyone's experience of frustration and so on and so forth is going to be different.
Right.
And then finally, to contrast some of those stories with Thoth, I downloaded Thoth knowing it was hard.
Mm-hmm.
And I played it and was bad at it knowing it was hard.
Right.
And I just expected, kind of like you were saying, Stephen, with some of the games you're playing, you expected to have it be difficult and to die a lot and to get better as you went along. And that's exactly what I did. And sometimes I would sail through a level the first time. I'd be like, wow, that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd die 10 times in the next one because it's just how it works.
Yeah.
I didn't really feel a lot of frustration in that game, even though it was really challenging.
Mm-hmm.
Until I got to like the randomized levels at the end, then I just kind of stopped. But it comes back to frustration again, right? Like I expected, and because of the normal levels in the game, I think there are 64 of them, I can't remember exactly, but like you do the sequence over and over again and you die and you start at the beginning of each of like the quadruplets that they have, And then you get to a checkpoint and you start the next one. You get to a checkpoint, start the next one. With the randomized levels, you don't know what you're going to get.
Yeah.
So you can't necessarily like progress in that same fashion. Your experience of progression isn't the same. And so the experience of frustration isn't the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that kind of rounds out the experiences I wanted to share. But I guess, is there anything else you guys want to add on, or maybe bring to a point on the relationship between frustration, difficulty, and expectations?
I think the one dimension we haven't quite hit on, but I mean, you touched on it just a bit, but we didn't get into it too much, which is the idea of like not knowing what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's still related to expectations in a way, but like the one for me was Humankind. We played that multiplayer a couple weeks ago.
Yep.
And I got really frustrated with it because I think I got placed in a weird part of the map too.
Yeah.
But I kind of was like, okay, this is going to be an extra challenge, and I was kind of going to accept it. But then it got really boring for me because like I didn't know what to do next. Right. Meanwhile, we're all on voice chat, and I'm hearing what everyone else is doing.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why is that not happening? Like, or you know. Whereas in Civ 6, when I'm falling behind everybody else, doesn't bother me that much.
Yeah.
Because I kind of have a better full understanding of those systems.
Right.
Whereas with Humankind, because I'm still new to it.
Yeah.
I was just very frustrated.
Yeah. And I remember you would, like, I had said that at a certain point, I was like, oh, I've gotten like 4 of the 7 stars. I need to move on. And then I remember you were at a point where you were like, how, I can't even imagine a world where I'm at that point at this moment in time.
Yeah. Like I had no conception of where they came from. So it wasn't me like, oh, I'm not doing good enough to get those. I'm like, how does anyone do anything to even know where that is?
Yeah, yeah.
And totally it was very frustrating because like, I didn't mind being in last place.
Yeah.
I just didn't know it. Like there was no possible mechanism for me. There was nothing for me to try and fail at.
Yeah.
Is what it felt like.
Yeah, totally.
And I think that's the thing where the early game just drags a little bit, maybe, might be part of it.
I don't know about, I can't speak to Humankind in that way, because I feels like the early, if Humankind has some problems. I think that the early game kind of is random in a lot of ways that are frustrating. Differently in Civ, and not like you can randomly spawn in a really crappy part of the map.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have good production or food or whatever. In Humankind, there's this whole era in the beginning where you play as an, you know, in the Neolithic era, and you're a bunch of tribes trying to hunt wildlife and grow to become eventually an actual civilization.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of randomization in that, like, sometimes you don't get any animals you can hunt till you can get more influence and stuff. Sometimes there's just not a lot of curiosities around you. The land could be bad around you and stuff.
And if you don't know the systems very well, you don't know how to adapt to that.
Yes.
And then when you were helping me, because you knew a lot more about the game. So you were telling me like what I would know if I'd played a few times, so I could make some choices. But then I just felt forced into choices by the state of the map.
Yeah.
And then it wasn't very fun.
Right.
I felt like I don't want to make this choice, but I have to, or else I'm not going to do as well.
Yeah.
And because I made the choice I didn't want to, now I have to lean into that. And my instincts are not. So it just felt like the whole thing felt more like a task than a game. At a certain point.
Sure.
But I suppose that will change with experience, because the game, I mean, I still like the game in a sense enough to try it again.
Mm-hmm.
If I have a few more experiences like that, I might just drop off it entirely.
Right.
But I feel like I really hope familiarity will help with that.
I think it would, but I think I see the direction you're going in that like the game did not describe how to get better.
Yeah.
And so there was no, at that moment, talking for you, I guess, but in that moment, like, it didn't feel like there was any way to get better. So, but other people were also doing better, so like it felt like there was no way to actually get to that point, or it wasn't clear how to get to that point.
Yeah. And it was less about like competition and more just about stuff to do.
Exactly. Yeah,
I just had no stuff to do.
Sure.
But that leads back to the whole thing you're talking about, Ellen, just this idea of like not being able to generate expectations. Mm-hmm. So like my expectations were that I would know what was going on, right?
Yeah.
And so a lot of games have that where like they, you know, they have weird controls, or they start at the difficulty curve is really, really steep.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess it's up to a game designer to engineer that frustration as surmountable.
Yeah.
Right? Like the goal for a game designer, if you want to make a hard game, you kind of have to accept that players will kind of hate it at the beginning. And you need to give them enough to motivate them to get past that feeling. Right, to either get familiar enough with it, because I think it could be very, if you're a game designer, it could be very tempting to just try to make everything, like a really polished user experience that feels lovely and friendly, mm-hmm. but then you're not making your game anymore. You're making an app.
Yeah.
Right? But that's the real challenge, right? To find that balance.
Yeah. When you're talking about like steep learning curves, I was reminded of my experience trying to learn EVE Online. It lasted 5 minutes. I was in space. My ship was gone. And I didn't know what to do. So I quit.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I guess what I'm hearing from what I think what we can maybe take away from this conversation about frustration and what leads to it and how to overcome it and the player experience when it comes to like principles we can apply to game design. I feel like I'm hearing a few different things. One, there's going to be frustration. Two, the experience of frustration is going to vary from player to player.
Yep.
It's not necessarily the same thing as difficulty. So if you want to make a difficult game, you also have to think about frustration as a separate thing, mm-hmm. I think. And you might decide that frustration is not desirable while difficulty is. Mm-hmm. So if you are going to go that route where you want to make something difficult, but you don't necessarily want to create something that's so frustrating that the player bounces off of it, you have to somehow work to set player expectations appropriately and make it seem fair. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, as I'm saying those words, Dark Souls comes to mind, like the whole series,
yeah.
because I hear that, you know, I'm not an avid player of Dark Souls, but Eric is. And one of the things I ask him about, I mean, like, why do you like the series so much? He likes it because it's difficult, but it feels fair.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he can get frustrated. Like anyone can get frustrated with playing games. He's playing Darkest Dungeon again right now. And he's, sometimes I'll hear him go, ah! I'll be upstairs and I'll just hear from downstairs. I never hear him do that with a Dark Souls game mm-hmm. because I think his expectations are precisely set where they need to be for the difficulty of the game.
That's how Neo felt too. Like, I expect it to be difficult. I expect to get beat up, but like, it's always when I fail, it's because I messed up. Mm-hmm. Whereas like the impression I get with Darkest Dungeon, having not played it, is that there's a lot of random things that will happen that will just make the game harder for you. And you can't really control that. You just have to adapt to it. Yeah. But in that moment, it would be frustrating.
Yep.
So, yeah, yep. I think that I feel like a lot of like the onboarding process would help with, you know, reduce the amount of frustration that people have with games. Because then if you have a better understanding of what the game is at the point, even if the game becomes challenging right away, you know that there's ways to get better or there are systems in place that you can learn about to improve your progress rate. I think that's a good aspect to it. And player expectation, I think is important too.
Yeah.
Which, you know, everybody's going to expect the game to be different. So, or they're going to expect the game differently.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I guess it's not, you can't exactly super control that in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
There's some things you can do about it, like the aesthetics and stuff. If the game is hard, like aesthetically make the game seem difficult.
It's about communication. You find different ways to communicate that to the player without, you know, beating him over the head with it, like putting a disclaimer at the beginning, this game is difficult.
Right.
But
also sometimes do that too.
Maybe sometimes do that too. Well, and I guess one of the things that we didn't mention is like having outlets. Mm-hmm. So like with Breath of the Wild, we were talking about how if you get stuck, you know, there's things you can do unless you're stuck on the Korok seeds. And you just at that point, you just have to grind your way out.
Yeah.
But like, if you're stuck on one of the main temples and those puzzles, then like going to some of the side quests or just riding your pony around and shooting stuff, cool things to do that are an alleviation for frustration. Or with Thoth, like if I'm trying to get past those randomly generated levels at the end, because there's a higher degree of randomness, there's a higher degree of frustration or higher capacity for frustration because. Right. The expectations are, you can't tune your expectations and the results as much because it's randomized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But if I get frustrated, I can always take a break and just go back and do some of the regular levels.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So having some kind of like release valves in the game might be a good thing too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, okay. I want to talk about the Discord. We have a Discord that you can check out, nicegames.club/Discord, and we have a lot of conversations about random topics that we maybe have talked about on the show, maybe haven't talked about on the show. Also, you can find some pictures of the new clubhouse on the Discord as well.
Yeah.
It's very fancy. You can see the couch. It's a nice looking couch. It's a very nice looking couch.
It's got some good pillows.
Yeah.
Well, aside from views from the new clubhouse, you can hear conversations with other listeners. Mm-hmm. And what's really nice is a lot of times a new episode would post and then some people would talk about the topic. And that's kind of what we wanted to start as. But what's starting to happen now is people are bringing their own conversations. They're actually now getting to know each other.
Yeah.
And they're starting to share things. They're actually connecting outside of that space and working on stuff together. So
yeah,
it's become a little tight-knit community right there in the Discord channel. And we'd love you to join them.
Yeah, yeah. You can go to nicegames.club/discord to join.
Puns welcome.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is a good conversation we had. I can't do the transitions.
we'll put in Martha's all-purpose transition here, and that'll save the day.
Yeah, you know that topic. It's time for the next one. Hey.
Perfect.
That was this topic. Yes, I'm talking about meetings today because I've had meetings at Future Club, my new job. I guess I've been there for 2.5 months. At a certain point, I can't call it my new job, but I'm still calling it my new job, I guess.
Right.
But anyways, we've been having meetings in Future Club and stuff, and they've been good compared to my previous job where we didn't have a lot of meetings at all, but I felt directionless a lot of the days.
Hmm. Yeah.
So I guess I'm here to argue that meetings can be good. They don't necessarily have to be a waste of time.
Right.
But I think there's some important things that you want to keep in mind when you scheduling or planning for meetings. I think it's important to make sure that you're having a meeting for a purpose. You don't just want to have a meeting for no reason.
Yeah.
That's a waste of time.
Yeah.
In my opinion, some of the purposes of meetings is to like get people on the same page about stuff, to discuss like possibility spaces. Like, I don't know if you want to figure out how should we take this character? What direction should this character go or something? Planning for like, you know, your next sprint. Or the next week, like, what are you going to be doing? Are there other reasons to have meetings? I guess, like, to coordinate with other people outside of your, like, company or business or something.
I mean, there's, you know, making decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, making decisions, right.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the people hate meetings generally because you don't walk out with a decision made.
Yeah.
Right? And so if you can make a decision in a meeting or have a meeting specifically to make a decision, you might end up liking meetings.
Yeah.
Expectations and frustration.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's why these topics are paired.
Brilliant.
Yeah. I feel like meetings generally like can save you time in the long run. because, like, you know, you'll have, you know, you make decisions and stuff about that. But I think that will slow you down in the short run, because, like, you have to spend 30 minutes, an hour or whatever, talking about stuff.
Right. It's work time you're spending.
And that work, I mean, I guess it depends on your actual job at a company, but I think that work, just talking about stuff, can oftentimes not feel like it's productive. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Even though it is, it'll be future productive,
yeah,
but not current productive.
Yeah. You have to think about how it feeds into your efficiency in your work overall, not just on, like, hour by hour or day by day scale, but, like, yeah, if you spend half an hour in a meeting to get answers directly from the source, as opposed to, like, spending, like, that half an hour spread out over 2 days via email,
yeah,
like, you're spending less time task switching. Mm-hmm. So that is saving you time in the long run.
Right.
Yeah.
Even though for that half an hour, you got to be focused on this meeting.
Right.
Yes. It's ultimately better time management, because you get the answers that you need, and then you can just move forward.
Yeah. The opposite corollary to that is meetings I used to have at an old job of mine, mm-hmm, where I would be in a meeting just to listen, just to, like, hear, like, a project kickoff or something.
Sure.
Just to hear. And that's important sometimes. But I also could have gotten that as emails sent to me over, yep, the course of, yeah, 2 days, because I wasn't engaging. I was just there to get the information.
Yeah.
I didn't need it in the meeting.
Yeah. Yep.
Right. So,
yeah.
I don't like those meetings. Like, send me the stuff. Let me digest it mentally. I'm not going to print it out and eat it, but, like, read it and understand it and come up with questions, so that when we have our kickoff meeting, it's not just reviewing information, but it's really, like, me making sure I understand what you sent me,
yeah,
and what you need. Like, that's I feel slightly meeting triggered.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's important. I think that, like, I think it's also important to make sure you're, like, directing the meetings so that you get the thing you need to get done, mm-hmm, right? Or if you get the thing you need to get done early, just end the meeting. Don't just talk about random stuff for 20 minutes, you know, because mm-hmm, you can still get work done.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you're just spinning your wheels and it's just wasting your time. That's what, I think a lot of people have frustration with meetings, myself included, when it just feels like there's a lot of stuff that is getting talked about that is irrelevant to the things you're doing, and you don't need to be there.
Yeah.
Like, I've heard it a bunch of times, you know, this could have been an email. Those, yeah, are the worst kinds of meetings.
Yeah.
Because they could have just spent the time to type up, mm-hmm, the four paragraphs or whatever, so you have all this information, and you don't need to be sitting there and having somebody explain this information to you for 30 minutes.
Yeah.
If you have questions, just email them back, and then you and that person can have a back and forth, and you don't have to waste five other people's time.
Yeah.
Do
you think some people do that, hold meetings when they could have just written an email, because they aren't confident that people will read the email?
I mean, sometimes that's a good reason to have a meeting. Like, depending on the people you work with.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Yeah, you have to know who you're working with.
It, like, establishes accountability.
Yeah.
In a sense. I mean, if that's the work environment you have, then that's not good news, but...
Well, I mean, so one purpose of having a meeting is to, like, discuss work that somebody has done and give feedback on that. Mm-hmm. Sometimes in the moment you want to give feedback, you know, like, through voice, because it's easier to describe the emotions or how you feel about this thing that they've done.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes you could just say in a Slack message, this looks good, or I don't like this thing. And it's easy to describe those things. And then if they have more questions about the feedback you've given or whatever, then y'all can have your own separate conversation outside of that.
Yeah.
But I think it depends on, like, the work you're doing and the team you're working with, whether or not it makes sense to literally hold a meeting for feedback, or to just, like, ask for feedback on your Slack or whatever, however you communicate.
Mm-hmm.
The
one problem you have with some in meetings is if no one's taking notes, or there's no after action report,
yeah,
mm-hmm, or something, then people can walk away with different memories of what happened.
Yep.
So Slack or email is usually better for making sure everybody is literally on, like, knows literally the facts at hand.
Mm-hmm.
And so meetings are good for processing those facts, you know, making sure everybody understands
right,
things that would be slower in email.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. I think that's when it's best. And Ellen was saying that too. Like, if your conversation would end up being, like, you know, spread out over a few days through email or text or what have you, then it's better to just have a meeting, because you can clear that up more quickly that way. And you won't spend, you know, the next few days being somewhat confused and messing up some stuff that could have been more quickly clarified earlier on. And so then, but it's hard to know, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if it's hard to know. I feel like, generally speaking, when I've like asked somebody, like, can I do a quick call with you to get this to work or whatever? Those calls have been really fast, like 5 minutes, 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Because like we know the purpose of the call is this one question.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Whereas like if you have a meeting that's like an hour long, there can be a bunch of different topics and it's hard to direct those ones specifically,
mm-hmm.
To get the answers you need to be able to work. That's harder.
Right.
Yeah. So I guess I want to talk about like when you should have meetings and when you shouldn't have meetings. I have some stuff written down. I don't think this is a end all be all of when you should have meetings or not, but mm-hmm. like, I guess I want to talk about them. Like, regular standups are good. Like, just 15 minutes every day saying, I'm doing this. I did this yesterday. I'm planning on doing this tomorrow or whatever. I think that's helpful because it keeps everybody knows what you're working on and you know what you're working on. So, everybody's on the same page with that. And if you're having difficulties, that would be standup meetings. They're a good time to bring that up because then it could be, you know, a future conversation down the line.
Yeah.
Planning for your week, planning for the next sprint. So you know what you need to work on. And you're not just, you know, working on things that are not valuable in the moment. Clarifying stuff, making sure that there's no confusion about things. You can just like, those can be like 5 minutes. I guess if you need more time, you could take more time, but making sure that everybody's on the same page about things is important. Getting feedback on work you've done. Outside conversations, I think these kind of have to be meetings. Like when you're having conversations with people outside of the business, you kind of have to make that a meeting because you're not going to be able to be in contact with them regularly, right? Unless it's through email, and that can be a very slow process because they're doing their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you kind of have to make those meetings in order for that to work.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then if you're working remotely, having like social meetings is good. Because otherwise you don't know the people you're working with.
Yeah, that's the one I was going to mention because the team, I mean, we're both working on remote teams.
Right.
And my team has one weekly meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't have an agenda because it happens every week.
Yeah.
And regardless of what's going on.
Right.
And so we do a little, everyone reports on what they've been doing for the past week, what they're going to do for the next week. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of the time is kind of brainstorming time.
Yeah.
So it's very unstructured. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the hallmarks of what we've described already is like bad things in meetings.
Yeah.
Which is just doing, you know, an aimless wander. Well, you know, but we need it because that's actual work time for us. It's not really a meeting anymore.
Yeah, yeah, working meeting.
We discuss design things. We throw out new ideas. Mm-hmm. We're like, well, if that's gonna, you know, and it ends up kind of going in random directions.
Yeah.
But as long as we do that thing up top, where we say what we're doing, what we did, and what we're doing.
Yeah.
And because our team is so small, that kind of works.
Yeah.
But it kind of only works because we're really remote. Mm-hmm. If we were all working in the same office, mm-hmm. I think that would just be better done. Walking from desk to desk or yep. whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like kind of just during the day.
Yeah, totally. Totally. I had that experience when I was working in an office. If I had questions about stuff, I'd just walk over to the desk and go, hey, can I ask you about this thing? And they'd be like, yeah. Or no, come back to me later or something.
Yeah.
And then they would cut, you know, it'd be the same thing. People would ask me questions.
Yeah.
But like you can just kind of do that intermittently throughout the day. Because, you know, you're all right there in the office. And I guess the same way kind of works when you're doing it through Slack. But, like if somebody has a question, they could just, you know, shoot off a Slack message going, hey, I have a question about this.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess what I was talking about with respect to this is like social meetings being like getting to know one another. And
right.
like feeling like you're working with humans.
Yeah.
And not just people who are supposed to give you work.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think that like the way you're describing it, Mark, with your team is that like you use that meeting as how long is that meeting? May I ask?
It is 20 minutes to 2 hours.
Oh, okay.
Depends on
very unstructured.
Right. And it's because we use it for work time if we need to.
Right.
And then sometimes it will just evolve into like what else is going on.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we just chat about whatever.
Right. Yeah. But the impression I'm getting with that is like you get the actual meeting stuff done right away.
Yeah.
And then the rest of that time is like kind of getting to know one another and also getting work done that you need to do mm-hmm. as a group.
Yeah.
So that makes sense. And so like it's kind of a social meeting in that like you're still getting to know each other while you're still working on the, you know, the rest of the tasks that you wanted to get done sort of in the meeting. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm talking about like there's this one thing that we've been trying to do. I think it's called Lunch and Learn or Lunch and something. Lunch and Learn sort of thing, where like you just spend an hour and like people on the team will bring like a topic to talk about for like
just 30 out. Minutes.
Yeah, kind of just hanging out. Okay. Also learning about stuff or getting to know other people's interests.
Yeah.
I brought one of the things I did is I brought Glom to my coworkers and we all played it together and that was really fun. And stuff like that. I think that's really important just so, you know, like I said, you know that you're working with other people and you get to know them a little bit better.
Yeah, with a remote team, that makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, because otherwise it's just a bunch of people on Slack. And like you can have, you can get to know people through Slack, through text, but it's not as, there's a certain amount that you need to know about other people in order to get work done better.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah, and trust. You got to build trust with your team.
Yes.
And that it's a tough thing. I don't know, Mark, if I would like to be part of your very, very unstructured meeting.
I could like hear you, the steam coming out of your ears.
Yeah, I felt like there were gears in my head that just kind of like hitched for a second.
Yeah.
Because I really like having working sessions, but I like that to be the expectation up front, right? Because like if it were a meeting that I expected to run for an hour and we were going to do these things, and then it ran for 3 hours,
oh,
it's
Lord.
Like.
The worst,
or two hours. It's like I don't want to leave because I don't want to leave my teammates hanging, but also I wasn't planning on doing this and the dogs need to be walked and then I have to make choices that I don't like making. Unless I'm expecting.
Later on in this we're pretty early in this project, so I suspect that there'll be less of that going forward, but part of it is because we don't have that thing you're talking about, Stephen, that structured social time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we kind of weave it in a little sort of informally.
Yeah. Yep. Makes sense.
That makes sense too.
And neither of us are really that worried about like getting the workday started because it's such a small team.
Yeah.
But like our accountability gets established during those meetings.
Yeah. Right? Good point.
It's like, I'm going to work for 6 hours on this thing. And then instead we have like an hour and a half talk about an unrelated design thing. And then We all do that with the understanding that it's going to change what the rest of our days look like.
Yeah.
We can be that flexible.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And yeah, it's interesting though, because what you were saying, Stephen, about like that social time.
Yeah.
It's really worth putting in some of that time regardless.
Yep.
Right. Mm-hmm. So if that's going to be, because if that's going to be through your unstructured meetings, you know, God bless, Godspeed. But
Ellen's being very generous with her description right now.
Bless your heart is what I'm hearing.
Yep, yeah, yeah.
Personally, I would prefer to like have my meeting and then be like, okay, let's chat later. And then like set up a time where we can just show up and play a game together online.
Sure, yeah.
Or like, I'm going to make a tea and we're just going to sit and chat or like look at funny memes or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like I'd rather have that time be its own.
I will say, so there is some value to doing something unoptimally.
Mm-hmm.
If optimizing it will take more time than the time you lose from the inefficiency.
That's true.
And I think that's probably the case for us.
Well, that's exactly what this thing, like meetings kind of do, right?
Yeah. It's
like odds, the goal is to optimize or improve productivity in certain aspects.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
At the expense of the work you could be doing during the meeting time.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, if that's the thing. If the meeting is going to take longer than it would take you to get the thing done, then like, why are you having the meeting?
Right.
I've definitely been tapping my toes in a meeting being like, I can just go do this. I can just go do this.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Let me go do this.
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't mean to say that like the top of the meeting is, you know, the meeting has started, it's top of the hour. Now it's all business. Like, mm-hmm. you know, there's always like in the meetings I'm a part of, I do like and encourage and participate in like some casual just checking in, checking up stuff.
Yeah.
Like at the beginning, and then usually there's like this kind of nebulous 5 to 10 minutes of that, depending on who's showing up when. And then it's like, okay, we're all here. We all checked in with each other as people. Now we're going to switch on business mode and it's focused work time.
And someone needs to have the authority to say, all right, enough chit chat, let's get going.
Yep.
And everybody needs to be like, oh, okay, sure. Like,
yeah.
I mean, whereas I think a lot of times in small groups, especially on indie teams, there's a lot of like, no one wants to step on each other's toes. No one wants to be the mean boss. No one wants to put their foot down.
Mm-hmm.
And then you lose a lot of more to that.
Yeah.
When you sort of don't have anybody sort of playing camp counselor.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. There's always the, well, shall we get, like, there's always like the take a deep breath and go, well, shall we get started? And then you can be that person without saying, so we're gathered here today to talk about blah, you know, because I think you're all, you know, your teammates are there because they want to get stuff done.
Yeah.
Right. Like, so it's, you don't have to, just because you're saying it's time to get down to work doesn't mean you're going to be the bad guy. Now, if you're always saying, stop talking about what you did on the weekend, I don't care. Well, then you're the bad guy.
Yeah. Right. Because it's just rude. And then you're just not interested in what other people are interested in.
Yeah. Well, you got to be a,
yeah.
You're working with people. So, yeah. Like, you got to be, care for them as people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's a balancing act.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I guess I didn't even think about like meeting decorum. That maybe is a different topic.
Oh, sure.
That's just like conversations.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's like, I mean, it's not just about attitude. It's just about like, when deciding when have we talked about something long enough?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know? When is it time to table it for the next meeting?
Yeah.
Because sometimes a topic is bigger than you thought it was going to be.
That's true.
You know, you want to have a structure. You actually want to be kind of rigid in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have to recognize when that's hurting your productivity.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, probably less often. But when it does, it's a pretty big hurt.
Right. And right? After a certain point, when you've talked about a thing for long enough, like, you're not going to get any more, you need some time in between talking about the thing. Mm-hmm. You need some time to like think about that and then come back to it later.
Yep.
Because otherwise you're just going over the same talking points over and over again. You can just do that for these are how my arguments with my brother have.
Yeah, well, you need a decision making structure. So
yes.
When you're arguing with your brother, there's no decision making structure,
right?
You just want us to convince the other, and that's never gonna happen.
Yeah.
The heat death of the universe will occur. But and sometimes people run meetings by consensus. It's like, well, let's keep talking until we all agree, or we all at least agree this is the way forward, even if we disagreed earlier or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes you just need someone in the room to be the person who decides, who takes it in and either goes away and decides or decides in the meeting.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Even though the argument has not been settled.
Yes. You know?
And that's hard.
Yeah.
One thing that my team lead really does, and I think works really well, is he encourages people to, you know, when there is a problem to be solved by the team, if you're the one who has identified the problem and you're going to bring it to the team's attention, also come with a potential solution, even if it's a bad potential solution.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because having that potential solution that people can react to is a good way to kind of kick off the process of decision making or additional ideation. Whereas if you say, hey, I have there's this problem that I noticed, what should we do about it? There's kind of like this moment where there are crickets.
Yeah.
And it's hard to get the energy moving around solving that problem.
Mm-hmm.
But if you bring a potential solution, again, even if it's a bad one and you know it's not a good one, if you bring it, it removes that moment where you need to get the gears turning. And if you start them already moving.
Yep.
So it's kind of a nice like brainstorming lubricant, I guess, to continue the machine metaphor.
Right. If you're the one bringing the problem, you've been the one who's thought about it most up to now. So it makes a lot of sense to help everyone along by having a solution they can decide is good or bad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One thing I do, and the two of you probably noticed it when we do our nice Games Club meetings, is I like to bring two solutions. I like to bring what I think we should do, but on the other hand, we could do it this opposite way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it frames. And one of them is usually my first idea that I want to do or makes the most sense.
Mm-hmm.
Then I always try to think like, well, if we don't do that, what will we do instead?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I want to present that also so that I'm not anchoring anybody to the idea I brought.
Yeah.
But also I'm not saying brainstorming a solution.
You know? Yeah.
I'm kind of setting establishing a framework, I guess,
mm-hmm.
which does buy us a room. Right. Yeah. So the you have to be careful of that. So you have to always make sure you're like, well, or none of these, or am I thinking about this wrong?
Yeah.
Right. Sometimes I say exactly that or something.
Well, yeah. And then you get a third idea that like maybe encapsulates the two ideas or whatever.
But it gets the ball rolling.
It gets the ball rolling.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's good. See, those are all good, important reasons to have meetings. I think that's solid. Not doing that is frustrating.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'm
Yeah, well, I guess like even with respect to like our nice Games Club meetings, because we have meetings sometimes to talk about.
Yeah.
Oftentimes we talk about like, what are we going to talk about the next time we record?
We have like regular agenda items and then we have like what's going on this month or whatever.
Yep.
Right.
Yep. But we try to, I would say that those are somewhat unstructured Because we're not like super focused, because we're also doing them in between recordings.
We've also been kind of lax on it the last few months.
Yeah, we haven't had any meetings in a while. It's not good.
They're often structured around food.
They are often structured, which makes it hard to get meetings done too. I guess that's something I want to bring up, like with respect to meetings. I think meetings
is this whole topic just Stephen telling us we have to do meetings better. Ellen, you think?
No, yeah, I would not be subtle about it. I'd be like, we need to do meetings.
Fair
also,
enough.
I haven't been asking for meetings either. So it's not like
Stephen.
Now it's my fault. I think meetings should be like an hour long.
Yeah.
If a meeting takes longer than that, it's two meetings or it's a working meeting.
Yeah.
So like what you're describing, Mark, where your meetings will sometimes go for 2 hours, it's because you're also doing work during that time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if a meeting is lasting longer than an hour, you either like this is like the work you're actually doing or you're wasting people's time.
Yeah.
And because sometimes there's just a lot of information that you need to, disseminate. Then you're like taking a class, I guess, sort of, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like people are learning about a thing or trying to understand a thing. So like you're literally doing work.
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess you're literally doing work when you're doing a meeting too, but it doesn't feel like you're actually doing work because it's not the same work that you were hired to do, sort of. Kind of. But
meta work.
It's meta work, yes. So I think it's important to structure your meetings so that you are able to complete them within an hour because if you take an hour of your day to get a meeting done, it feels like you can have a productive amount of work done in the meeting and still get stuff done that you need to get done. But if you start doing 2 hour long meetings, an hour half long meetings, it starts to feel like you're not getting as much stuff done as you wanted to get done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it just kind of feels like you're wasting your time.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important to try to make sure that your meetings are an hour long. I'm not subtweeting or anything like that. Cause we don't have longer than hour meetings at Future Club generally. I'm just saying, do that.
Yeah. It's hard to prescribe truisms. Everything should always be this, but that's probably the closest one meetings really shouldn't go over.
Yeah. And if it needs to go, like you said, Mark, if it needs to go longer than an hour, you need 2 meetings.
Yeah.
You don't have to make it 2 hour long meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or
you need to make it 2 hour long.
Or it needs to be so structured that you move on from topic to topic in a way that I think because a meeting longer than an hour can just be physically exhausting for people.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's one reason enough, but really if it's just about content, you really can't talk about one thing for more than an hour without doing something about it.
Yeah.
And coming back to it.
Yeah, exactly. And again, if you're talking about the same topic for 2 hours, then after a certain point, you will just start spinning wheels and revisiting these same things you have been talking about.
Right.
You need some time to process what has been said during the meetings, come back to it, and then reexamine where you are with that idea.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's just not productive.
And if the topic is so big that it does fill more than an hour, then you can break it up into smaller topics.
I'm realizing that this episode is longer than an hour.
It was more than one topic.
Good point. So we're clear.
You'll get the time code.
Well, meeting adjourned then. Hey, that's our show. Check out our website, nicegames.club, for show notes and links to resources on today's topics. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode and our programming in general. Go to nicegames.club/feedback and tell us what you think. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter at nicegamesclub, where Dale tweets about game dev resources and smiling water towers. Or you can email us, contact@nicegames.club. Want to support the show? There's so many ways. Give us a review in your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends about your favorite episodes. Join us on Discord by visiting nicegames.club/discord. And also, we are on Patreon. As a patron of the show, you'll enjoy bonus content, extra jokes, and more. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice. What a great meeting we had about frustration. Does that count?
I mean, B minus.
Okay, I'll take it. It's a B minus kind of day. Should you do the call to action?
Yeah.
Okay. I picked Discord, thinking we had stuff to talk about with respect to the Discord.
I'm sure we can talk about some stuff.
Oh, I think I did that because Mark, you posted pictures of the clubhouse and the Discord. So we could talk about it in that respect.
Yeah, let's do it.
Cool. Hold on, let me think.
You gave me a B minus, and this is what Stephen gives us to enter the transition.
Yeah, but Stephen's taking this course pass fail, so
he's on an audit, right?
It is sometimes frustrating to come up with transitions to new topics.
Hey, that wasn't bad.
B minus.
Yes, that's passing.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.